Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Amy Tan, who has a new novel, Saving Fish from Drowning. Earlier novels include Joy Luck Club, The Kitchen God's Wife, Bonesetter's Daughter. The previous book is a collection of essays titled The Opposite of Fate. Amy Tan, this book is a departure for you. It is not about the relationship with your mother in various ways or your life. This is a comic novel set mostly in Burma and featuring 12 characters, 12 genres. You've kind of used as a framework the Canterbury Tales. So rather than start with why Burma, let's start with why Canterbury Tales.
Canterbury Tales is something that I always had loved. I studied it when I was in college. And the whole idea of 12 people going on a journey and telling their moral tale was intriguing to me. There was also a character in there named Harry Bailey, and he was the innkeeper, and the travelers all went to him and started telling their tales, and he was so intrigued he joined them. In this story, I thought, let's do a little turnabout here. And Harry Bailey, spelled the same way as in Canterbury Tales, ends up not going on the journey. He was with them, the 12 people, and he's the single person who stays behind and tells his version of what's happening.
You began writing this book virtually immediately after finishing Bonesetter's Daughter. What prompted you to write a picaresque comic novel set in Burma?
Well, the origins of that started actually in 1989 with the events of Tiananmen Square. And I had people say to me, you should go to China and stand on Tiananmen Square yourself and denounce the government. At the time, I was feeling, boy, should I do this? You know, knowledgeable people are saying that. But at the same time, I was concerned that it would actually be detrimental to my family. And I wondered if it would also be the same with others. Would it really make a difference? Over the years, I had been asked to do similar things, and I wondered about intentions and the choices we make in doing something and what the actual outcomes would be. And if the outcomes were good, did we take credit, especially if they were better than we anticipated? And if they were bad, did we take blame? What responsibility did we have then? This all gelled when I was given an opportunity to join an art expedition going to Myanmar, which is also known as Burma. I think, as most people did, that Myanmar had some things that had been going on that were very unpleasant about 10 more years ago. But things must be better because they're doing tours there. And as I did some research, I found that wasn't the case. In fact, things were worse. So I was faced with this moral dilemma. Do I go or do I boycott?
What year was that?
1999 is when the opportunity presented itself, and that was the year that my mother died. I went on this trip at the end of 2000 and followed pretty much the itinerary that these travelers follow. I started in China, in Yunnan province, in the foothills of the Himalayas, in a place that's been dubbed the Shangri-La of China, you know, a name that everybody lays claim to get tourists to come. Well, I read Lost Horizons, James Hilton's book, again, and I found in there this time a much more sinister meaning to the notion of Shangri-La. It was the notion that you must suppress your passions and you must not agitate in a way that you must be like other people and be at peace with the circumstances you have found yourself in. And it occurred to me that this is sort of the mentality that a lot of repressive regimes say to people. And if you are given with this philosophy, this mindset, that it is much easier to just accept that kind of suppression of yourself, your own identity. I mean, that's what happens to those travelers in Shangri-La. Those who say, no, I'm not accepting, I got to get out of here. They say, you're going to die, but if you are just quiet and peaceful and go along with the status quo, you'll live a long time. Well, isn't that what repressive regimes say? You know, if you make a big fuss, we're going to get rid of you. If you play the game, you're going to live longer. And it suddenly became, it seemed to me, part of the focus of Burma. It's funny how I never saw that in a way. And then I started thinking how art is an expression of the spirit, and really that art despises those still waters, that placidity where you haven't really stirred up anything new. You haven't done any kind of personal discomfort and protest about anything that's going on. And then, in a way, you haven't created art. You haven't created anything new. So it all started to merge in my mind.
Well, if art is subversive and these people are going to Burma, Myanmar, to look at art, in a sense, their goal is a subversive one.
It is, but they don't know, in fact, that they are going there to be subversive. I knew they were going, that I was taking a fiction that would be subversive, that the whole travel log adventure and mystery and, you know, all that was a subversive or a seductive, I prefer seductive, seductive way to get myself and perhaps the reader into a place you would enjoy, you know, some of the aspects of the story, and you'd laugh a little and you'd want to know what happened to these characters. Did Harry and Marlena ever get it on? But also, then you would reach a place, as you do in some tours, that was not quite what was in the brochure. And there you would then ask yourself about your own beliefs and your own sense of yourself in that country, your own survival skills, and how that related to other people.
The travelers, before they arrive in Myanmar, they get really sick at a very strange series of restaurants. They go to one natural foods restaurant. Is there such a restaurant, first off? Secondly, the really bad restaurant where they all get sick. Did you encounter a place like that in China?
Well, the natural foods, as you call it, they were things like wild pick mushrooms, about 20 different kinds. And I actually went to that restaurant. It's amazing. You know, and at first I was so tired, I was thinking of skipping that meal. And later I thought, boy, what I would have missed out on. Eventually, we were going down the road, and we just said, let's just keep going, you know, and change the itinerary from what the tour leader had planned. He had tested all the restaurants out and vetted them for cleanliness and quality of food. But we said, oh, let's just stop at this roadside place. And what you see in the book is exactly what we saw. It was so disgusting, and I couldn't eat it. And after I went to the bathroom and looked at, you know, people who had eaten this stuff, I was very proud that I had stuck to my instincts. We had people who got sick. I don't know if it was from that experience, although, you know, it takes about 3 days for dysentery to strike. That's about when people got sick.
The tour, up until the moment when our 12 or 11 travelers disappear into the wild, up until that time, their itinerary was pretty much your itinerary and many of their adventures your adventures.
It was. I mean, I skipped a few towns that perhaps weren't as interesting. But it was. You know, the place that we stayed at with the Chinese couple who barely spoke Chinese, but they were Jewish. They said they were Jewish, and they had a menorah plus a Christmas tree that said, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah. It was so bizarre. You know, you have this surreal feeling when you're in another country and you see something like that. It disconnects all over the place.
When I was reading the novel, there are certain sections where I laugh. Uh-huh. And it occurs to me those are not the put-on section. They're not the made-up stuff.
No.
They're the real stuff.
And the absurdities that were real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it brings up something about the nature of fiction that on some level, and I've heard this from several authors, fiction really can't top reality for either weirdness or coincidence.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes you have to consider whether you can write about the reality because it's so over the top and people say, oh, you've gone too far. You know, that is so improbable. The whole thing about the drunk people underneath and the thin walls and you could hear everybody's digestive problems, that was all real. And the fact that these drunk people then snuck out in the middle of the night, stumbled, you could hear everything, they, you know, left without paying their bill, and you knew what was going to happen to them.
That does bring up a question, which is, when you begin writing that, how hard is it to keep that inner censor quiet, the censor that says, nobody will believe this one, but I'm putting it in there because it happened?
Well, this time, I started off with the absurd. I started off with a fictional foreword, a note to the reader, in which I am claiming that I received this story through archives I found, automatic writing. A ghost has produced this through the help of a medium, 900 pages of a story in which she explained what happened to these 12 people.
So you felt free at that point having done that, and you did that in order to, well, for one thing, obviously to give your a voice, which you say at some point is kind of your mom's voice,
yeah,
but
yeah.
to give a voice for the novel, because she could then comment on everything. But then also it seems to have allowed you a certain freedom. It was kind of a package gift.
It was, and you have a narrator who is a little outrageous. She's opinionated. She says things that are inappropriate. She needs to know things, and she does know things. So she could be absurd. She could witness things. She was a perfect narrator for looking at absurdities in life.
But it also allows you to say, to just do it, to not
care. To do it, not care, not, you know, from the outset. This is what it is. This is absurd. And I'm going to get into some really serious absurdities about what is going on there.
Amy Tan, after reading Saving Fish from Drowning, I picked up your collection of essays, The Opposite of Fate, which came out a couple of years ago, and I noticed a huge chunk of the beginning of the book is devoted to ghosts and your mother's obsession with ghosts and the fact that a ghost of a murdered friend spoke to you. So this is material you're very familiar with.
I am, and I've resisted it and then been attracted to it. It's a push-pull kind of thing, and that's good. You know, it's caused me over the years to question what this whole notion of life after death, consciousness after death, what that means to a person and how it affects what they do in life and look for in terms of meaning. I was raised by a father who was a Baptist minister and a mother who believed in many things. I would say her religion was pragmatism, that whatever worked or whatever gave her the most hope is what she believed in at the time. I think that's transferred to me, that often I look at a situation and feel that there are many possibilities. I can be a skeptic. Skeptic in that old sense that you are open to looking at possibilities. Not skeptic in the meaning that you are closed now automatically from the start to a particular possibility.
Using Bibi Chen then also gives you the opportunity to add the story of your friend Pete, who was able to effect change in the real world after he passed on,
yeah,
as she does.
Yeah. Pete was actually, the experience with Pete was the most, I don't know, if I were looking for proof of the existence of something that beyond death, it would be that and some of the experiences with my mother afterward. But it was such a prolonged and strong influence, his death, and what came to me in the form of dreams that turned out to be true.
After your mother passed away, have you and her communicated?
Well, I have had some experiences, mostly through dreams, that there was one particular experience that was very, very strong. And it was 24 hours after she died. Most people are, as I was in a terrible state of grief. And I missed her much more than I thought I would after preparing myself for 4.5 years for that moment. I was awake. I was sitting up. All of a sudden, I saw what seemed to be my mother in a hologram, larger than life, her face about, I would say, 3 feet in length, coming toward me, just her face, three-dimensional, made out of light. I was mesmerized. And the moment she would have touched me in real life, I had this instant fusion of emotion I have never had in my life. And it was a feeling that of peace, love, and joy. And I realized that those things were all the same. It was so profound, and I felt exactly what she felt. That's what I sensed, that I didn't need words, that everything was communicated at the purest level. And then my husband came into the room, and he could see that I was staring at something, and I had this look of rapture on my face. And then I kept waiting for it to come back. She, you know, sort of disappeared, dissipated. And then I said to him, "You'll never guess what happened." Well, at that point, he said, "You'll never guess what happened." Bubba, my dog, who never leaves my side, raced down the stairs to get Lou, who's at the computer, barked at him in Lassie fashion, saying, "You know, come here, hurry, follow me." And never had done that. Lou kept saying, "What's wrong, Bubba?" And he finally said, "Did you see a ghost or something?" Bubba just went running up the stairs, looking at him, barking, and he followed Bubba, and that's when he found me sitting there. You know, you could say it's all coincidence. You could say that in grief, through imagination, I saw this. You could say that maybe I had a seizure, which I was having at that time.
That was the Lyme disease, right?
Lyme disease, I was later discovered. But, you know, in all my seizures that I've had since then, I have never had an emotional experience. It's all been very distant. It has no context or meaning to me. It's just things that are happening.
There's something that happened with your mother, and I think might have happened with your father when they had their tumors, which is that they began seeing people who weren't there. And I recall a friend of mine, when I was a teenager, his mother had a cancerous tumor, mm-hmm. and toward the end, she had long conversations with people who weren't there. And you start to wonder, are they hallucinating, or are they just perceiving a different reality?
Right. I mean, you know. Well, of course, the scientists would say, or the doctors would say, that it is all some sort of neurological activity as you're, you know, getting more and more brain damaged as you leave. And the hospice nurses did say to me, it happens almost all the time. So you wonder what this all the time means. All the time could also mean that, I mean, I've postulated the possibility that as our physical membrane is leaving us, perhaps we now are able to go into another aspect of consciousness, that our consciousness maybe doesn't exist simply in three dimension and time, that it exists in multiple dimensions that we're simply not aware of. We can't be aware of once we're in this particular membrane.
Do you get the feeling sometimes when you're writing? Because I know a number of writers kind of, it's almost like automatic writing when they're really flowing, that you're actually tapping in, or is every word a struggle?
Well, there is a tremendous struggle, especially in the beginning. But often there reaches a point where the writing becomes less of a struggle and becomes almost effortless. And you come to write things that are surprising, and you wonder where that came from. You say to yourself, I didn't know that. How could I have written it? And you have then a moment of elation. And that is the high that makes writing so worth it. You feel grateful. And at the same time, you worry it will never happen again. So, yes, I think that's what people mean when the writing becomes automatic. It comes from a place you can't put your finger on.
Do you remember the point in Saving Fish from Drowning when you hit that moment, that epiphany?
There was an epiphany at the point when these people are in the jungle with the Quran. It's so desperate, and they begin to do the music for their death, the Quran. And something happens, and their consciousness does a little shift, the Americans who are there as well. And I realize that that moment was very much what I felt when my mother had come to me. I sensed that what is going on there, that feeling of peace and hope and joy and love and everything, was also compassion. And that even if you didn't know what to do for another person, that connection, that compassion was very important for us to experience, not just to give to people, but to experience that within ourselves.
You're listening to an interview with Amy Tan, whose latest book is Saving Fish from Drowning. Amy Tan, the tribe, the Karen tribe of Myanmar, Burma, they exist.
Yes, they do.
And the story in there, the myth of the younger white brother, is a real myth.
Yes.
And the guy from 150 years ago who wrote a book on poker, is he real?
Part real. I had read a story, just some brief reference to somebody who had taken advantage of the Quran over 100 years ago and pretended to be some sort of savior. There were missionaries who went to Burma over the last 150 years, and I think that the Quran were particularly amenable to accepting a Christian doctrine because they had this myth of the younger white brother and the missionaries being, you know, white, and they carried with them the important writings that the Quran were also looking for. They didn't have a formal written language, and they felt that this had weakened them. And so there was a lot of that. But there was a magician as well who wrote a book that is used by all magicians today, that he was the master, and his name was never really known. His name was S.E. Erdnase, and people have speculated what the name referred to. It's obviously Andrews backwards, but who was he? And people have tried to come up with possibilities, but none of them really fit. So I decided to write the identity of this Erdnase, this Andrews, who now in my story is called Serafinius.
What happens in the book is the 11 travelers are taken to this village because one of them is assumed to be their god, and they're trapped there. It reminded me in a weird way of
Midsummer Night's Dream?
Well, partly that, but also Ann Patchett's book, where the kidnappers and the kidnapped come together and become as one, only this was a comic version.
Part of this is when we are thrown in a situation that is quite dire and we are outside of our own set of circumstances we're used to, outside of what we assume to be the way life works, suddenly we also have to question who we are among other people, who we are to the rest of the world, and how can we use that to either survive or deal with this very serious situation. That is fascinating to me. I mean, who our essential selves are when we're placed in a potential life-threatening position. I think it happens when you have a life-threatening illness, when you are facing a certain kind of death.
So to that degree, you could almost say that this story encapsulates some of the same ideas that you would have had to go through with Lyme disease, that you had to go through with your parents when they were dying, and that your parents had to go through in escaping China.
This is really interesting because you have pointed out something I have not thought of as obvious until you just articulated. And yes, the opposite of fate to me when I was ill was trying to change fate. I felt that somehow this tick biting me out of all the other people who were there, why me? That it was some sort of fate. And so the same thing with these travelers. Why them? How did this come to be? And you're wrestling with all the reasons why things happen. You know, was it fate? Was it their own blindness in making the wrong choices? Was it other people's actions and their own innocence? Was it sort of bad luck? Was it just randomness? And I think that I went through all those questions, both with the death of my father and my brother, you know, the coincidence of two tumors, brain tumors, within the same year, both of them dying in that same year. My mother having a brain tumor, and then she dying of a neurological disease, and then my getting a neurological disease. What was the pattern about? And so here these people are too. How did this happen?
This brings up something about the nature of fiction, which is that on some level, fiction isn't creative, but it's more like this weird discovery, which the audience may or may not get, but that has to be going on in the writer's mind.
I think writers write because they have a perverse curiosity about things that maybe should be left alone, uncomfortable things, nasty things, evil things, and then they pursue it and find things they can't even anticipate. The discovery is the reason why you write. It's not something I know ahead of time. But I think the reader does think that we know from the beginning what the end is going to be and what we're going to find, and we just have plotted this all out on 3x5 cards and we put it up on our wall and we just follow it very systematically, just plug in the words.
Some writers do that, particularly very heavily plot-driven novels. Mm-hmm. But even with those, the operative word that comes up with a lot of writers, what are you doing here? And the answer is, I am exploring. And the question is, what is exploring in the context of telling a story?
I think it's a meditation on questions that are very, very personal. People are saying, this is a departure from what you've been doing. And the departure, I'm starting to think I'm on a train platform, you know, trains coming and taking me away. But no, I'm still on the same platform. I am asking these questions that relate to my beliefs and where I got these beliefs. Got a lot of them from my mother. I got a lot of them that were based on what happened in the past. What happened? How do things happen? And I am applying that to my fiction as well, and using a particular focus called the question. And what happens when you have this focus is that all of your experiences then on the outside world, day to day, become filtered through that question, that focus. And as you write, then, everything is also streaming through the same focus. It's a very long meditation, and it's a lot of chair sitting.
The meditation is happening in the context of a metaphor.
Yes, metaphor, images. I don't know all of the metaphors or the, I don't know all of the symbols or whatever people call this when they analyze fiction. I don't think that I want to know ahead of time. You know, later on, people get the book and, you know, they write cliff notes or they assign them as term theme papers to students. And they then find these patterns and the relevance of things that happen here and there and how I use the same color over and over again or the same number. Or as you pointed out, which I think is very true, something that I didn't realize, that in my illness and in the and my father and my brother, that all of these sort of circle around the same theme of fate and why, you know. So it's very useful also to hear what writers have to say. But, you know, you are sort of the idiot savant in some ways as you write.
I think you have to be, because if you're not, then your sensor begins, you know, sending out, you know, neon lights to your brain and you're kind of going, do I want to reveal this? So it's almost better maybe.
Or you become, you make it more contrived. You know, you do have to have some contrivances, but then if you are too conscious of all of it and the patterns, then I think that you lose the freshness and the discovery. I love the surprises, and they make me very excited as I write, and it pushes me forward. If I don't discover anything, I get very discouraged and feel I've fallen into an abyss, and I have to find something that will lift me out.
Now, this book has come out, and you're finally back to yourself after this long struggle,
so
mostly. Mostly. Have you begun thinking, working on another book?
I have started thinking. People say, have you started writing? And that so much to me about writing is thinking about the book and thinking about the questions, the character, the voice. And that happens almost every waking moment that I have. Although some of it's taken up by an opera that I'm working on with a composer, Stuart Wallace. That's based on The Bonesitter's Daughter. And that's a form of creativity that also is, I think, relevant to the book I'm thinking about. I'm writing libretto, which really surprises me. I had such a naive notion about opera, even though I've seen many operas, that I thought you had to somehow jam the words in with music that had already been written. I didn't understand how the collaboration worked. But then as I got into it, I found that it was very natural and comfortable that you do what I did actually in collaboration making the film. You sit down, you talk about the heart of the story, what it means, where you're going to go to, this larger emotional arc. You break it down into the acts, two acts. What are each of the scenes? What are the beats of each scene? Where do you move narratively in each? Where do you deepen the emotion? Is this part a repartee among the people, a harmony, or just single lines? And where do you have the arias, which is when you bind everything together and deepen and deepen and tie in everything that's going on and still move it forward.
You've been listening to an interview with Amy Tan, whose latest book is Saving Fish from Drowning. Amy Tan will be at Clean, Well-Lighted Place for Books in San Francisco on Monday, November 14th at 7 p.m. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.